Why is your vote so important? Because it is the primary way of getting attention for the things you believe in. If you miss this invaluable opportunity, there will be no voice for what you care about. The issues may be neglected and resources placed elsewhere. Notice how many needs of the injured, sick, and disabled are underfunded or near the end of the to-do list for many politicians. Can the largest minority in the world be ignored when voting? No. Approximately 26 million votes are difficult to overlook. Is your vote more valuable than money? Oh yes, it's the driving force behind where the money goes. This is why using it must be done in 214, because holding politicians accountable matters. Vote those people out in 214 that have not operated on your behalf and see how it will make a change. You will see how it gets their attention. All that is required is for you to act upon what is important, to challenge the barriers recently put in place hindering voting, along with district changing to benefit those who have something to lose. Yet all their efforts are futile if you make the decision to vote in 214. Thank you for joining me, Estra, this September 21st, 2013, for Talking About You with Estra on Blog Talk Radio and Estra's TV, currently featured on YouTube under Estra's blog. Make sure not to be diverted to another link. My official website is Estra, pronounced Estra. So go to Estra's Blog Tips on Blogger for a listing of all legitimate links. This is your car accident show, sharing information and concerns that help you, family, friends, and communities from an injured person's perspective, meaning the person hurt in a traffic collision. Today's topic will be on why your disabled vote is important. For far too long, the needs of the disabled, poor, and middle class have been ignored, bowing to the needs of the 0.1% of our country, prospectively speaking. There was a time when perhaps our religious values kept morality and human decency at levels where consciousness would hold individuals and companies in check. In my opinion, today, this has moved to the almighty dollar, which for me means it's time for every U.S. citizen to exercise their right to vote. This is where polls and influence are sought for the 99%. It would be nice if the effects of lobbyists are constrained by respect, dignity, and being one's brother's or sister's keeper. However, now this depends on staying alert with the actions and behaviors of those choosing the direction of the country and helping them to stay in office or move them out if hurting those most in need, such as the injured dealing with ERISA, poor and old middle class needing jobs, homes, and food. Who in America thought hunger would extend to as many people as it does today? And Congress has the nerve to cut food stamps? Who are these people? And what do they really stand for? Also in our program today is personal injury in the news, providing comments on events and holidays of the coming week, my commentary on why your disabled vote is important, and last but not least, discussions on articles related to our topic. Disabled people have the right to vote. A disability does not prevent you from doing your duty as a citizen. If you know what is important to you, in my opinion, vote to hold on to those things considered valuable. In today's program, let's see what the law says about and how you can prepare to vote in 214 elections. In this program, your challenges in dealing with insurance companies, self-insured employers, and coping with everyday situations from being involved in a car accident are up for discussion. Dial 718-766-4385 to share your comments on why the disabled vote is important. Again, that's 718-766-4385. The after show number has changed. Place your comments at Talking About You with Estra on Facebook or tweet at Estra's Radio Show. If watching on YouTube, make sure to leave your comments. Tune in every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio, or view every Wednesday on Estra's TV, YouTube user Estra's blog. We are coming to you from Seattle, Washington.
Other notable mentions this week include President Obama speaking this week regarding our economy and the importance of what will be happening soon. In my opinion, in order to make good decisions today with so much propaganda, try your best to hear it firsthand so you're getting the facts. When talking about you with Esther, believe it's important to hear, we'll bring it to you. Hear it from the president at the end of the show. Our next notable mention is first day of autumn, September 22nd, 2013. And calendarupdates.com says, quote, on the first day of autumn, day and night are nearly the same amount of time. In the United States, there are about 12 hours of daylight on this day. The reason for these changes has to do with Earth's yearly trip around the sun. For part of the year, the Earth's north pole points away from the sun, and part of the time towards it. This is what causes our season. When the North Pole points towards the sun's rays hit the northern half of the world more directly. This means it's warmer and we have a summer. For more information, visit calendarupdates.com. Our next notable mention is Native American Day, which is September 27, 2013. Native American Day is a holiday in California established in 1968 to honor Native American cultures and contributions to the state and the United States. Also called India Day, it is observed annually on the fourth Friday in September. In 1968, Governor Ronald Reagan signed a resolution calling for a holiday of American Indian Day to be held the fourth Friday in September. In 1998, the California Assembly passed AB 1953, which made Native American Day an official state holiday. In 1989, the South Dakota legislature unanimously passed legislation proposed by Governor George S. Michelson to proclaim 1990 as the year of reconciliation between Native Americans and whites, to change Columbus Day to Native American Day, and make Martin Luther King's birthday into a state holiday. Since 1990, the second Monday in October has been celebrated as Native American Day in South Dakota. If you want to read more about it, you can actually go out to wikipedia.org, where it has a good description. It's nice to see the contributions made, which are many, by Native Americans acknowledged and respected. This is a great time to learn about a culture that oftentimes surrounds us without our awareness. Leaving stereotypes behind is long overdue. Make a difference and learn how we now all live together and bring gifts of knowledge and wisdom to the table. Our next mention is National History Black College and University Week. President's Proclamation actually talks about it a bit. We're just going to read just a short portion of it. It's out at whitehouse.gov if you want to read the full proclamation. Quote, before the Civil War, an education, much less college education, was out of reach for most African Americans. There were few institutions focused on meeting the intellectual curiosity and spurring the academic growth of African American students. But as our Union began to heal from the wounds of war, and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment were signed, a freed people demanded a freed mind, and courageous leaders began to expand what we now know as our nation's historically black colleges and universities, and it's known as HBCUs, if you want to know the acronym. And I just want to stop here for just a moment because it's something really important, not only with African Americans having the opportunity to get an education. A free people demanded a free mind. And I think that's such an incredible quote, because it's the same thing with being in a traffic collision and making sure that you're making decisions in your best interest. A freed mind is such an important thing to hold on to, especially when you're dealing with a lot of situations that are requiring your attention that may not necessarily be in your best interest. More than a century and a half later, we cannot overstate the role HBCUs have played in the narrative of our country. These are the institutions that have helped build a middle class and produce some of our nation's preeminent thinkers and entrepreneurs, doctors, scientists, judges, and lawyers, service members, and educators. These are the schools where students banded together in open fields and assembly halls as part of a movement that pushes us closer to true freedom and equality for all. And these are the campuses where generations of students not only gained the education and skills necessary for the workforce, but also cultivated an understanding of history and knowledge of self that are necessary in life, end quote. And I think that's so very true. I think it also applies after Congress has cut the money for our educational system, making it very difficult for 99% of the children in America to get a decent education, to learn how to think, to have self-respect. And dignity. If those things don't happen, then as a society, we're not going to go far. Some people in our society might have enjoyed the United States being dumbed down. However, 99% of people, I'm sure, have not and have suffered substantially at the hands of those with a pen. They don't have to consider what's going to happen. They believe that their family's going to be okay. But think about society. You can't guess what's going to happen or know the future. So when you're cutting funds and you're cutting education and you're cutting food stamps, you do not know that it won't at some point come back to haunt you and your family. Okay, I think this is the last notable mention. It's National POW MIA Recognition Day, and timeanddate.com states, quote, "The United States National POW MIA Recognition Day is observed across the nation on the third Friday of September each year. Many Americans take the time to remember those who are prisoners of war, which is a POW, and those who are missing in action, which is the MIA part, as well as their families." I also found some interesting information in Wikipedia. It says, "The day was established by an act of Congress by the passage of Section 1082 of the 1998 Defense Authorization Act. It is one of 6 days that the POW-MIA flag can be flown. The POW-MIA flag was first recognized by Public Law 101-355 in 1990. The POW-MIA flag should lie below and not be greater than the United States flag. It is generally flown immediately below or adjacent to the United States flag as second in order of precedence," end quote. I was fortunate enough to go to the post office the other day, and I noticed they had the flag up on the pole. It was the first time I've actually seen it in all these years, which is kind of amazing. We need to give these soldiers and the families their respect for doing something very few in our country right now are participating in. And that's one thing I think would change the way in which our laws are implemented, is if everyone will have to serve the United States military. Now, our personal injury section. How many traffic collisions did you see or hear about this week? Did it have an impact on your day? Were you late for work? Did it involve you or someone you know? Were there major, minor, or no injuries? If the car accident does not directly impact us, it may seem unimportant. But when it does, it can be life-changing. And if life-changing, it would be nice to have health care. Therefore, if you do not have medical insurance, make sure to sign up starting in October. COBRA is far too expensive for most people to pay, and if you lose your job, you don't want to lose medical care. Life will be hard enough without worrying about how to get the help you need. The Affordable Health Care Act passed because too many American people were suffering in silence with their condition. Don't do that anymore. It is time to get the care you need. Check out healthcare.gov for yourself. Make up your mind with real facts, not fiction. A car accident is not the time to be without medical treatment, or a year later if requiring long-term care without a job. The next time you see an accident on the road, think about if it were you. Are preparations in place? Since we started with personal injury in the news, individuals are asking themselves this question. What's your answer? I hope it's yes, I am prepared. And if not, make sure to pick up a copy of Car Accident by Astra. It's available at all major bookstores. Yeah. Now for my commentary on why your disabled vote is important. Your vote tells local, state, and federal politicians that your needs are important to their election efforts. By bringing issues such as ERISA reform, group disabilities policies that should be treated the same as individual ones because they offer fair treatment options and remedies, therefore making a difference in the life quality of disabled. Learn today how much your vote really counts. For decades, disabled voters struggled to cast their votes as U.S. citizens, a participation which is crucial in electing officials who have a vested interest in the same concerns as those who face daily challenges caused by injury, sickness, disease, poverty, or the injustices now confronting the middle class. Voting obstructions to voting booths, assistance to arriving at the polls, and the ability to read voting ballots are easy remedies for people requiring limited help. Many states have already made these adjustments to some of the polls. Check your location, and if you need additional services, let them know. You matter, and your vote is important. If unable to remove barriers, how can you vote? So be creative and also give your public officials an ability to help. How can politicians be convinced your causes are their concerns too unless a vote is counted? Regardless of the current condition, if your vote is not represented, neither will the needs, meaning the funding required for research in finding solutions and benefits available to improve the quality of life for specific injuries will be underfunded. Being one of the largest minority sectors, approximately 26 million votes count. All citizens deserve respect, dignity, and the ability to cast a vote. There is much discussion regarding people with disabilities to decide on what and whom to vote for. In my opinion, if you know that a candidate's choosing to cut benefits, eliminate programs developed for your use, decrease services which improve quality of life, people should be able to cast a vote to protect their interests. By providing mechanisms for people to be informed on the issues and politicians, along with access to voting, our choices in governing will reflect more of our society as a whole. Vote this 214. It matters, you matter, and it counts. The Department of Justice has actually an email address of voting.section@usdoj.gov. That's voting.section@usdoj.gov that you can contact with any civil rights issues regarding voting. Their phone number is 1-800-253-3931. Again, that number is 1-800-253-3931. Or the mailing address is Voting Section Chief, Civil Rights Division, Room 7254, NWB, Department of Justice, 950 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20530. Again, that's directed to Voting Section Chief, Civil Rights Division, Room 7254, NWB, Department of Justice, 950 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20530. Do not hesitate to contact them with any of your civil rights issues regarding being able to vote. Being disabled should not prevent you from voting. And if anyone is trying to, contact them. You have a right to vote. And don't let any barriers to entry stop you. On the Department of Justice website, you'll actually find the Voters' Right Act of 1965, and so I want to make sure that you're familiar with the history of it, because sometimes we don't realize what we're fighting for, what we have, until we realize what someone else has done to get us to where we are, or what we need to do to hold on to it. Quote, By 1965, concerted efforts to break the grip of the state disenfranchisement has been underway for quite some time, but had achieved only modest success overall in some areas had proved almost entirely ineffectual. The murder of voting rights activists in Philadelphia, Mississippi, gained national attention along with numerous other acts of violence and terrorism. Finally, the unprovoked attack on March 7, 1965, by state troopers on peaceful marchers crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, en route to the state capitol in Montgomery, persuaded President and Congress to overcome Southern legislators' resistance to effective voting right legislation. President Johnson issued a call for a strong voting rights law, and hearing began soon afterwards on the bill that would become the Voting Rights Act. I want to stop here for a moment. In order sometimes for things to change, we must take action. We can't sit back and allow things just to happen to us or to accept things that people want us to. Sometimes you have to get into the battle. And that's true as far as car accidents are concerned, dealing with insurance companies and self-insured employers and any other agencies that you might be working with where you're not actually being able to get your long-term disabilities. Make sure that you realize that you might look at this information and think of it on a historic perspective, but you actually also need to look at it in terms of where we are today and what you as an individual and us as a community and a country need to do to keep us moving forward and not fall back. Because unfortunately, as we know today, there's a lot of states right now that have changed the districting and have done it in an effort to keep control over how our government is run. And I don't believe that's really how the Constitution is meant to be. It's meant to allow everyone to have a single vote, and the decisions and the direction of our country is influenced by that, not in privileged few holding on to the rights of a country. I'm going to go on here. Quote, Congress determined that the existing federal anti-discrimination laws were not sufficient to overcome the resistance by state officials to enforcement of the 15th Amendment. The legislative hearing showed that the Department of Justice efforts to eliminate discriminatory election practices by litigation on a case-by-case basis had been unsuccessful in opening up the registration process. As soon as one discriminatory practice or procedure was proven to be unconstitutional and enjoined, a new one would be substituted in its place and litigation would have commenced anew. So, in my opinion, we're seeing a lot of these same strategies being used in a lot of our systems today. And unfortunately, in my opinion, I think we see a lot of that as far as people who have been injured in car accidents. For one, the same thing is the case where most people do not have resources to fight large corporations, and therefore, unless the federal government protects our interest, and that's why I'm so wanting ERISA reform to be done, then people who are injured will not have that. And the same thing with voting. Voting rights also need to be protected. In fact, we're seeing that now because of what's being done to try to provide a leaning towards a direction in our elections. In my opinion, hopefully we'll stand up and we won't let that stand. Okay, I'm going to go down. I recommend you actually go out and take a look at the whole act so that you get a good understanding of it. I'm just going to highlight a couple other points here. Section 2 of the Act, which closely follows the language of the 15th Amendment, applied a nationwide prohibition against the denial or abridgment of the right to vote on a literacy test on a nationwide basis. Among its other provisions, the Act contained special enforcement provisions targeted at those areas of the country where Congress believed the potential for discrimination to be the greatest. And that's the one that we're seeing that I'm not sure what the Supreme Court was thinking, but that's a whole other story. Section 5, its jurisdictions covered by these special provisions could not implement any changes affecting voters until the Attorney General or the United States District Court for the District of Columbia determined that the change did not have discriminatory purpose and would not have a discriminatory effect. So, as a disabled voter, realize you cannot be discriminated against. You have a right to say and to vote for the things that impact your life, your family, your friends, your community. And you don't have to be disabled to take that stand. It's just about making sure that the needs of people who have been injured or disabled or sick, there's a lot of the list, as I say, is endless on this, can be represented in our voting. Comments on the topic articles to review today are my opinion and have no association with the writers of the articles unless, of course, it comes from Astro's blog tip. And as usual, I'll be stopping and making comments. The first article actually we're going to talk about actually comes from disableinaction.org, and I actually came across this website and found it quite interesting. So I'm going to do something I usually don't do and just tell you a little bit about them because I thought this was fantastic. From their website, it says, "What is Disabled in Action?" And their acronym is DIA. Quote, "We are a civil rights organization committed to ending discrimination against people with disabilities, all disabilities. We fight to eliminate the barriers that prevent us from enjoying full equality in American society." Founded in 1970, DIA is a democratic, non-for-profit, tax-exempt membership organization. DIA consists primarily of and is directed by people with disabilities. We believe in the motto, "Nothing about us without us," end quote. And I just thought that's very fascinating, and it's very true that everyone needs to be a part and get involved. We all have something to contribute, so whether we're abled or disabled, spend time sharing what you know, because I guarantee you somebody out there needs it. They had facts about disability in the U.S. population, and I thought that that would be interesting to actually list some of the things they have there. But make sure to go out to their website to actually get a full listing of it. It says population distribution. It says 51.2 million number of people who have some level of disability. They represent 18% of the population. 51.2 million, okay, that's a lot of people. 32.5 million is the number of people with severe disabilities, and they represent 12% of the population. 11% of the children ages 6 to 14 have disabilities. This amounts to 4 million children. 72% of the people 80 and older with disabilities, the highest of any age group, that's 72%. 20% percentage of females with a disability higher than the 17% of males. So 17% of males, 20% of females. On the other hand, among children under 15, boys are more likely than girls to have a disability, which is 11% versus 6%. I thought that was interesting. So it goes on and it talks about a lot of numbers. So let me give you just a couple more here. 14.3 million is the number of people with limitations in cognitive function or mental or emotional illnesses that interfere with the daily activities. This includes those with Alzheimer's disease, depression, and mental retardation. This group comprises 6% of the population. 2.6 million is the number of people aged 15 or older who have some difficulty having their speech understood by others. Of this number, 610,000 were unable to have their speech understood at all. So in that case, it's really wonderful how technology is coming along. Let's see, it says 11.8 million is the number of 16 to 64-year-olds who reported the presence of medical conditions that make it difficult to find a job or remain employed. They comprise 6% of the population. Realize that whatever you're going through, there's a lot of you out there, and you have a lot to give, not only to people who are going through the same thing you're going through, but in educating other people and getting rid of stereotypes and the opportunity to become and live your life to the fullest, regardless of the situation or your condition. So that's just a fantastic information. 22,000 is the median earnings for people with a non-severe disability. Compare this to 25,000 for those with no disability and 12,800 for those with severe disabilities. So we see that there's a major gap there. And then just look at the difference in that number and the actual number amount of money that the average person has, which is $50,000 as the average family income, and it shows you how much more difficult life can be. So we all need to be out there supporting each other, especially with the Congress that we currently have, in which they've demonstrated is the worst Congress in U.S. history, and is also doing very little to support the ones who need it most in our society. And that's why it comes back to you voting in 214. Thanks so much for being a part of today's show. There's just so much more information and facts I wanted to present to you today. This means that our next show will definitely have a lot more to talk about. Make sure to join me again next Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time for Talking About You with Estra on Blog Talk Radio and Estra's TV, users on YouTube, users blog, Estra. Now, let's listen to what our president had to say for this week.
Good afternoon, everybody. Please have a seat. Before I begin, let me say a few words about the tragedy that's unfolding not far away from here at the Washington Navy Yard. That's part of why our event today was delayed. I've been briefed by my team on the situation. We still don't know all the facts, but we do know that several people have been shot and some have been killed. So we are confronting yet another mass shooting. And today it happened on a military installation in our nation's capital. It's a shooting that targeted our military and civilian personnel. These are men and women who were going to work, doing their job, protecting all of us. They're patriots. And they know the dangers of serving abroad, but today they face the unimaginable violence that they wouldn't have expected here at home. So we offer our gratitude to the Navy and local law enforcement, federal authorities, and the doctors who've responded with skill and bravery. I've made it clear to my team that I want the investigation to be seamless so that federal and local authorities are working together. And as this investigation moves forward, we will do everything in our power to make sure whoever carried out this cowardly act is held responsible. In the meantime, we send our thoughts and prayers to all at the Navy Yard who've been touched by this tragedy. We thank them for their service. We stand with the families of those who've been harmed. They're going to need our love and support. And as we learn more about the courageous Americans who died today, their lives, their families, their patriotism, we will honor their service to the nation. They helped to make great. And obviously, we're going to be investigating thoroughly what happened, as we do so many of these shootings, sadly, that have happened, and do everything that we can to try to prevent them. Now, in recent weeks, much of our attention has been focused on the events in Syria. The horrible use of chemical weapons on innocent people, including children, the need for a firm response from the international community, and over the weekend we took an important step in that direction, towards moving Syria's chemical weapons under international control so that they can be destroyed. And we're not there yet, but if properly implemented, this agreement could end the threat these weapons pose, not only to the Syrian people, but to the world. I want to be clear, though, that even as we've dealt with the situation in Syria, we've continued to focus on my number one priority since the day I took office: making sure we recover from the worst economic crisis of our lifetimes and rebuilding our economy so it works for everybody who's willing to work hard, so that everybody who's willing to take responsibility for their lives has a chance to get ahead. It was 5 years ago this week that the financial crisis rocked Wall Street and sent an economy already into recession, into a tailspin. And it's hard sometimes to remember everything that happened during those months, but in a matter of a frightening few days and weeks, some of the largest investment banks in the world failed, stock markets plunged, banks stopped lending to families and small businesses, our auto industry, the heartbeat of American manufacturing, was flatlining. By the time I took office, The economy was shrinking by an annual rate of more than 8%. Our businesses were shedding 800,000 jobs each month. It was a perfect storm that would rob millions of Americans of jobs and homes and savings that they had worked a lifetime to build. And it also laid bare the long erosion of a middle class that for more than a decade has had to work harder and harder just to keep up. In fact, most Americans who've known economic hardship these past several years, they don't think about the collapse of Lehman Brothers when they think about the recession. Instead, they recall the day they got the gut punch of a pink slip, or the day a bank took away their home, the day they got sick but didn't have health insurance, or the day they had to sit their daughter or son down and tell him or her that they couldn't afford to send their child back to college the next semester. And so those are the stories that guided everything we've done. It's what in those earliest days of the crisis caused us to act so quickly through the Recovery Act to arrest the downward spiral and put a floor under the fall. We put people to work repairing roads and bridges, to keep teachers in our classrooms, our first responders on the streets. We helped responsible homeowners modify their mortgages so that more of them could keep their homes. We helped jumpstart the flow of credit to help more small businesses keep their doors open. We saved the American auto industry. And as we worked to stabilize the economy and get it growing and creating jobs again, we also started pushing back against the trends that had been battering the middle class for decades. So we took on a broken healthcare system. We invested in new American technologies to end our addiction to foreign oil. We put in place tough new rules on big banks. Rules that we need to finalize before the end of the year, by the way, to make sure that the job is done. And we put in new protections that crack down on the worst practices of mortgage lenders and credit card companies. We also changed a tax code that was too skewed in favor of the wealthiest Americans. We locked in tax cuts for 98% of Americans. We asked those at the top to pay a little bit more. So if you add it all up, over the last 3.5 years, our businesses have added 7.5 million new jobs. The unemployment rate has come down. Our housing market is healing. Our financial system is safer. We sell more goods made in America to the rest of the world than ever before. We generate more renewable energy than ever before. We produce more natural gas than anybody. Healthcare costs are growing at the slowest rate in 50 years. And just 2 weeks from now, millions of Americans who've been locked out of buying health insurance just because they had a pre-existing condition, just because they've been sick or they couldn't afford it, they're finally going to have a chance to buy quality, affordable health care on the private marketplace. What all this means is we've cleared away the rubble from the financial crisis and we've begun to lay a new foundation for economic growth and prosperity. And in our personal lives, I think a lot of us understand that people have tightened their belts, shed debt, refocused on the things that really matter. All of this happened because ultimately of the resilience and the grit of the American people. And we should be proud of that. And on this 5-year anniversary, we should take note of how far we've come from where we were 5 years ago. But that's not the end of the story. As any middle-class family will tell you, or anybody who's striving to get into the middle class, we are not yet where we need to be. And that's what we've got to focus on. All the remaining work that needs to be done to strengthen this economy. We need to grow faster. We need more good-paying jobs. We need more broad-based prosperity. We need more ladders of opportunity for people who are currently poor but want to get into the middle class. Because even though our businesses are creating new jobs and have broken record profits, the top 1% of Americans took home 20% of the nation's income last year, while the average worker isn't seeing a raise at all. In fact, that understates the problem. Most of the gains have gone to the top 1/10 of 1%. So in many ways, the trends that have taken hold over the past few decades of a winner-take-all economy where a few do better and better and better while everybody else just treads water or loses ground, those trends have been made worse by the recession. That's what we should be focused on. That's what I'm focused on. That's what I know the Americans standing beside me, as well as all of you out there, are focused on. And as Congress begins another budget debate, that's what Congress should be focused on. How do we grow the economy faster? How do we create better jobs? How do we increase wages and incomes? How do we increase opportunity for those who have been locked out of opportunity? How do we create better retirement security? That's what we should be focused on, because the stakes for our middle class and everybody who's fighting to get into the middle class could not be higher. In today's hyper-competitive world, we have to make the investments necessary to attract good jobs that pay good wages and offer high standards of living. And although ultimately our success will depend on all the innovation and hard work of our private sector, all that grit and resilience of the American people, government is going to have a critical role in making sure we have an education system that prepares our children and our workers for a global economy. The budget Congress passes will determine whether we can hire more workers to upgrade our transportation and communications networks, or fund the kinds of research and development that have always kept America on the cutting edge. So what happens here in Washington makes a difference. What happens up on Capitol Hill is going to help determine not only the pace of our growth, but also the quality of jobs, the quality of opportunity for this generation and future generations. The problem is, at the moment, Republicans in Congress don't seem to be focused on how to grow the economy and build the middle class. I say at the moment because I'm still hoping that a light bulb goes off here. So far, their budget ideas revolve primarily around even deeper cuts to education, even deeper cuts that would gut America's scientific research and development, even deeper cuts to America's infrastructure investment, our roads, our bridges, our schools, our energy grid. These aren't the policies that would grow the economy faster. They're not the policies that would help grow the middle class. In fact, they do the opposite. Up until now, Republicans have argued that these cuts are necessary in the name of fiscal responsibility. But our deficits are now falling at the fastest rate since the end of World War II. I want to repeat that. Our deficits are going down faster than any time since before I was born. By the end of this year, we will have cut our deficits by more than half since I took office. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't still have some long-term fiscal challenges, primarily because the population is getting older and they're using more healthcare services. And so we've still got some changes that we've got to make, and there's not a government agency or program out there that still can't be streamlined, become more customer-friendly, more efficient. So I do believe we should cut out programs that we don't need. We need to fix ones that aren't working the way they're supposed to or have outlived their initial mission. We've got to make government faster and more efficient. But that's not what is being proposed by the Republican budgets. Instead of making necessary changes with a scalpel, so far at least, Republicans have chosen to leave in place the so-called sequester cuts that have cost jobs, harmed growth, are hurting our military readiness. And top independent economists say this has been a big drag on our recovery this year. Our economy is not growing as fast as it should, and we're not creating as many jobs as we should because the sequester is in place. That's not my opinion. That's the opinion of independent economists. The sequester makes it harder to do what's required to boost wages for American workers because the economy is still slack. So, if Republicans want the economy to grow faster, create more jobs faster, they should want to get rid of it. It's irresponsible to keep it in place. And if Congress is serious about wanting to grow the economy faster and creating jobs faster, the first order of business must be to pass a sensible budget that replaces the sequester with a balanced plan that is both fiscally sound and funds the investments like education and basic research and infrastructure that we need to grow. Now, this is not asking too much. Congress's most fundamental job is passing a budget. And Congress needs to get it done without triggering another crisis, without shutting down our government, or worse, threatening not to pay this country's bills. After all the progress that we've made over these last 4.5 years, the idea of reversing that progress because of an unwillingness to compromise or because of some ideological agenda is the height of irresponsibility. It's not what the American people need right now. These folks standing behind me, these are people who are small business owners, people who almost lost their home, young people trying to get a college education, and all of them went through some real tough times during the recession, and in part because of the steps we took, and primarily because of their courage and determination and hard work, they're in a better place now. But the last thing they're looking for us to go back to the same kind of crisis situations that we've had in the past. And the single most important thing we can do to prevent that is for Congress to pass a budget without drama that puts us on a sound path for growth, jobs, better wages, better incomes. Now look, it's never been easy to get 535 people here in Washington to agree on anything. And you know, budget battles and debates, those are as old as the Republic. It's even harder when you have divided government. And right now, you've got Republicans controlling the House of Representatives, Democrats controlling the Senate, Democrat in the White House. So this is always going to be tough. Having said that, I cannot remember a time when one faction of one party promises economic chaos if it can't get 100% of what it wants. That's never happened before. But that's what's happening right now. You have some Republicans in the House of Representatives who are promising to shut down the government at the end of this month if they can't shut down the Affordable Care Act. And if that scheme doesn't work, some have suggested they won't pay the very bills that Congress has already run up, which would cause America to default on its debt for the first time in our history and would create massive economic turmoil. Interest rates on ordinary people would shoot up. Those kinds of actions are the kinds of actions that we don't need. The last time the same crew threatened this course of action back in 2011, even the mere suggestion of default slowed our economic growth. Everybody here remembers that. Wasn't that long ago. Now keep in mind, initially, the whole argument was we're going to do this because we want to reduce our debt. That doesn't seem to be the focus now. Now the focus is on Obamacare. So let's put this in perspective. The Affordable Care Act has been the law for 3.5 years now. It passed both houses of Congress. The Supreme Court ruled it constitutional. It was an issue in last year's election, and the candidate who called for repeal lost. Republicans in the House have tried to repeal or sabotage it about 40 times. They failed every time. Meanwhile, the law has already helped millions of Americans. Young people who are able to stay on their parents' plan up until the age of 26. Seniors who are getting additional discounts on their prescription drugs. Ordinary families and small businesses that are getting rebates from insurance companies, because now insurance companies have to actually spend money on people's care instead of on administrative costs and CEO bonuses. A lot of the horror stories that were predicted about how this was going to shoot rates way up and there were going to be death panels and all that stuff, none of that stuff's happened. And in 2 weeks, the Affordable Care Act is going to help millions of more people. And there's no serious evidence that the law, which has helped to keep down the rise in healthcare costs to their lowest level in 50 years, is holding back economic growth. So repealing the Affordable Care Act, making sure that 30 million people don't get health insurance and people with pre-existing conditions continue to be locked out of the health insurance market, that's not an agenda for economic growth. You're not going to meet an economist who says that that's the number one priority in terms of boosting growth and jobs in this country. At least not a serious economist. And I understand I will never convince some Republicans about the merits of Obamacare. I understand that. And I'm more than willing to work with them where they've got specific suggestions that they can show will make our healthcare system work better. Remember, initially this was like repeal and replace, and the replace thing has kind of gone off to the wayside. Now it's just repeal. But the larger point is, after all that we've been through these past 5 years, after all the work Americans like those standing behind me have done to come back from the depths of a crisis, are some of these folks really so beholden to one extreme wing of their party that they're willing to tank the entire economy just because they can't get their way on this issue? Are they really willing to hurt people just to score political points? I hope not. But in case there's any confusion, I will not negotiate over whether or not America keeps its word and meets its obligations. I will not negotiate over the full faith and credit of the United States. This country has worked too hard for too long to dig out of a crisis just to see their elected representatives here in Washington purposely cause another crisis. Let's stop the threats. Let's stop the political posturing. Let's keep our government open. Let's pay our bills on time. Let's pass a budget. Let's work together to do what the American people sent us here to do: create jobs, grow our economy, expand opportunity. That's what we need to do. And as far as the budget goes, it's time for responsible Republicans who share these goals. And there are a number of folks out there who I think are decent folks. I've got some disagreements with them on some issues, but I think genuinely want to see the economy grow and want what's best for the American people. It's time for those Republicans to step up, and they've got to decide what they want to prioritize. Originally, they said they wanted deficit reduction. As I said before, our deficits are falling fast. The only way to make further long-term progress on deficit reduction that doesn't slow growth is with a balanced plan that includes closing tax loopholes that benefit corporations and the wealthiest Americans at the expense of the middle class. It's the only way to do it. They said that they wanted entitlement reform. But their leaders haven't put forward serious ideas that wouldn't devastate Medicare or Social Security. And I've put forward ideas for sensible reforms to Medicare and Social Security, and haven't gotten a lot of feedback yet. They said that they wanted tax reform. Remember, this was just a few months ago. They said, well, this is going to be one of our top priorities, tax reform. 6 weeks ago, I put forward a plan that serious people in both parties should be able to support, a deal that lowers the corporate tax rate for businesses and manufacturers, simplifies it for small business owners, as long as we use some of the money that we save to invest in the infrastructure our businesses need to create more good jobs and good wages for middle-class folks who work at these businesses. My position is, if folks in this town want a grand bargain, how about a grand bargain for middle-class jobs? So I put forward ideas for tax reform. Haven't heard back from them yet. Now, Congress has a couple of weeks to get this done. If they're focused on what the American people care about, faster growth, more jobs, better future for our kids, then I'm confident it will happen. And once we're done with the budget, let's focus on the other things that we know can make a difference for middle-class families. Lowering the cost of college, finishing the job of immigration reform, taking up the work of tax reform to make the system fairer and promoting more investment in the United States. If we follow the strategy I'm laying out for our entire economy, and if Washington will just act with the same urgency and common purpose that we felt 5 years ago, then our economy will be stronger a year from now, 5 years from now, a decade from now. That's my priority. All these folks standing behind me and everybody out there who's listening, that's my priority. I've run my last election. My only interest at this point is making sure that the economy is moving the way it needs to, so we've got the kind of broad-based growth that has always been the hallmark of this country. And as long as I've got the privilege of serving as your president, I will spend every moment of every day I have left fighting to restore security and opportunity for the middle class and to give everyone who works hard a chance to get ahead. Thank you, everybody. God bless you. God bless America.